After such wonderful chanting, then God expects me to stand up and say something. Had a wonderful week, and going up to Vancouver Island, up to Courtney and Hornby Island, and we were treated so well in both places, and wonderful devotees, and there's just nothing better in the entire world than to get together and talk about God and realization and the path. It seems to be all that I really care about or that I can focus my mind on. And to get together with devotees who are sincerely and honestly aspiring for higher truth, to have satsang, a gathering around truth. What is the truth? Finding the truth, realizing the truth. Can there be anything any greater than that in the world? Any higher calling? And I think not. I think not. I bring back the love and well wishes of so many of the devotees up there. I wanted to continue from last week's talk on happiness and finding that happiness. And Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, this comes from chapter 18, verse 38. And Krishna speaking, saying, that happiness which springs from the conjunction of the senses and matter is termed rajasic, and it seems like nectar in the beginning and like poison in the end. That happiness which springs from the conjunction of the senses and matter is termed rajasic. It seems like nectar in the beginning and like poison in the end. And last week, Krishna was saying that that which seems sattvic, good, of God, in the beginning, it seems like poison in the beginning, and then like nectar afterwards. So now we have just completely the opposite. And Master's commentary, the nature of happiness born of the passionate blindness of rajasic actions is described here. A person who experiences physical pleasure after strenuous effort to attain it enjoys for a while the ambrosial nectar of a gratifying happiness. But this is inevitably decimated by the poison of dissatisfied happiness as the impermanent sensory pleasure wanes. When a boisterous young man works hard and with difficulty saves money to buy a rickety car, he is extremely happy with his first wild outings in it. But as soon as he meets with an accident or has to spend a considerable amount just to keep the dilapidated vehicle in working order, he begins to taste the poison of unhappiness. One who gluttonously swallows more food than he can digest finds joy in satisfying his inordinate greed. But the after effects from overeating are discomfort and eventual disease. The sexually overindulgent person yields to temptation until his eyesight, nerves, physical vigor, self-control, inner peace, sense of propriety, and sense of honor are completely shattered. His enthusiasm about sexual pleasure changes into devastating mental depression that may even lead to dementia. The alcoholic or the habitual drug user feels elation at first, but afterwards is plunged into despair when the effects of the liquor or narcotic wear off. And isn't it true that all of these things happen? And yet we go on in life as if we are going to get some different result. There is a saying that says that when you're faced with two choices, then choose the harder of the two, and it'll probably be the right one. And there's a truth in this because of what Krishna is saying, that the sattvic is more difficult at first, and then it gets sweeter and sweeter with time. Whereas the role of the senses, and being dictated to by the senses, is most agreeable in the beginning. But the cost for going down that road gets higher and higher as we go along. So it is tempting and beyond temptation to go into the realm of the senses. There is a saying from the 60s that says, if it feels good, do it. But we can see where much of that philosophy has gotten us as we see the role of alcohol and drugs and sex addiction have taken their toll upon a generation and succeeding generations afterwards. It is indeed tempting to think that why not just go ahead and indulge the senses? Why not go ahead and do what I want to do? Because it feels good and I have that right. I have the freedom. And I want that freedom. But Papa says that freedom does not come through license of behavior, but it comes through seva, through serving. And it is through serving that we really find our role in the world becomes complete. Service doesn't think of the self first and the world later, if at all. Service thinks of others first. First of all, God. God is put first. What would you will for me, Lord? What would you want for me? And even if our attunement is imperfect and perhaps leads us down wrong roads at times, our sincerity will always help us to self-correct. It is vitally important that we are sincere. Those that I know of who have fallen from the path have done so with a decision. And that decision leads them down the wrong way, but they don't self-correct. They don't get themselves back on track again. Rather, out of stubbornness or out of pride or out of ignorance, they keep on going down that path, many times believing that that's exactly the right thing for them to do. But as they go down further and further that path, it gets darker and darker. And suddenly, the spiritual path that they are following, the bliss, the joy that they had experienced, seems like a dream or non-existent. It seems to them that what they were living before was perhaps a phase that they were going through rather than genuine spiritual experiences. And when this happens, the mind gets so convinced of its rightness that there is very little turning back at that point. You become dulled to the inner senses, the finer senses, that which senses bliss, that which senses joy and purity and truth. Now you think to yourself, well, I'm just this human being and I'm going to live this life the best that I can and live it out to the end. And truly you have the free will to do this, but what is the result of it? The result is you spiritually go to sleep. And when you spiritually go to sleep, you lose the better part of your nature. Now you are seduced into following this path of the senses. Now you are going further and further down that road until it makes you so miserable, so out of sync with who you really are, that finally you cry out to God. There must be a better way. There must be a path. But in particular, as Jesus pointed out, those who reject the Christ, those that reject the Guru, they suffer a particularly difficult path because the Guru does not make themselves immediately available. Now, this is not because the Guru withholds themselves. It is simply because a matter of karma. I remember reading the story of Gopi Krishna. And he started in, he was meditating and getting deeper and deeper into it. And then without any knowledge or awareness on his part, suddenly the kundalini erupted. Now there are many people going around today teaching a kind of kundalini yoga or awakening of the kundalini. And fortunately for most people, they don't actually awaken it because most people are not prepared for the power and the tremendous transformation that occurs when this happens. And even if they were to trigger it, would there be anyone around who could help them with this? And so when that happens and there is no teacher, there is no guru, there is no one experienced in order to help them through that, they can get into real trouble. There was an aspirant that came And she had awakened that kundalini. And she didn't know, and nowhere was there anybody about her who knew what to do with this. And when I met her, she was in real trouble. She was in danger of extinguishing that light that was within her. And through time, she came into a greater state of balance and was all right and got everything focused in the way that it should be, at least for a period of time. And so it is vastly important that we have that experienced one around us. Now, some people shun the idea of having a teacher or a guru. They think, well, I can do this through self-effort and through self-direction. I can learn how to meditate. I can read a book. I can listen to a lecture, and I can learn how to do that. And now I'm on my own, and that's the way that I like it. And that's all right for a period of time. But at some point, you have to come to that stage where you meet that one who can take you into the higher realms. It's as if you are going to ascend one of the great mountains in the world. And even the best mountain climbers need guides. They need a Sherpa. Sherpas will guide them up the path and even carry the load, the vast part of the load, for the mountain climber. But guess who's taking the picture and who gets their picture taken? It's the man who's not carrying the full load who gets his picture taken and his name in the paper. Poor Sherpa is behind the camera taking the picture. And with few exceptions, they are not noted at all. And yet here they are carrying these tremendous loads all the way up to the top of the mountain. It's quite a thing, isn't it? So we must recognize that this role of the teacher, this role of the guru, is a necessary one when the soul is ready to ascend into those higher, lofty altitudes. And at that point, they are most necessary. They can be useful all the way along, but at that point, they are absolutely essential if we are to make that journey all the way, all the way. And so we learn the basic do's and don'ts, and this is the ABCs that Krishna is talking about here. That we learn to go for that which is sattvic, even though it is difficult for us. We learn to meditate, even though the mind is rampant with thoughts, even though the body is restless. Yesterday we had a silent Saturday and a 6-hour meditation of silence and meditation. And it's the most wonderful time. And there is no replacing the longer meditations. Because the longer you go, you sense yourself dropping down through various levels. And most people don't do it on their own, so it's nice to come and do it as a group. Plus, there's the synergy that gets created within a group. As Jesus said, where two or more are gathered, there I am. And so you go through those difficult moments where perhaps if you were alone, you would just give it up. But since you're in a group and it's a structured setting, you keep going. And then suddenly, through the struggle, suddenly you drop down to a new and deeper level. And you feel the difference. You feel a deeper sense of calm, a deeper sense of joy. And you have that for some time, and then some other obstacle comes up. And down and down and down you go. As Swamiji said, dive deep, soar high. Dive deep so that you can soar high. And so we take this kind of discipline, but at first it's not easy. And people are looking for easy answers. They're looking for the easy way. Isn't there an easier way? I remember when I was first getting on the path and I was reading some books. And some of those books said that you can get that through drugs. Well, that seemed to be all right if you can get it that way. You don't have to do the hard work of the other way. And yet there comes many, many dangers and pitfalls that comes with the drugs, and the results are uncertain. And certainly, as Mother said, they are not an earned experience. So you may be even granted glimpses of the interior kingdom of heaven. But they can only be glimpses. They cannot be the total thing. Because that can only come as the pearl of great price that can only come when you have really made the effort. We have to get away from the alcohol and from the drugs and the other things in order for the nervous system to settle down and to be strengthened so that it can withstand the tremendous power that comes with realization. There is a complete and total transformation that goes on within your system. And it is physical, it is astral, it is causal, and it is all being spurred on by the spiritual. Now, when I first started into these experiences, they felt like it was going to stretch me in every which way until I was broken. But somehow I was never broken, although it seemed to take me to the brink of it at different times. And it was a long and difficult path. And once the Kundalini starts, it's not something you can just turn off because it's inconvenient or you don't like it right now. I remember one time we were having a potluck at the basement of the church. And we realized that we needed a tablecloth for one of the tables there. So I didn't live far from there, so I got in the car and came back to the house. And just as I was grabbing a tablecloth, I was sitting there, and a tremendous wave of bliss came up through my spine and took me over. And I was there for quite a while, and I was out of my control. And even though there are people who are waiting for me back at the service, wait to get the tablecloth down so that the eating could begin, I had no control over this, and I just was inebriated with this bliss. And finally, I came down enough that I could open my eyes a bit, and I grabbed a tablecloth, and off I went. And by the time I arrived to the church, it was realized that I grabbed one of the fitted sheets instead of the flat sheets, so it didn't do any good anyway. But you have to be able to surrender to this when it comes, and even I say be able to surrender, and yet there's something inside that takes over. And it's not just a matter of you surrendering, it's just being able to allow it to move through you. You see, there's an intelligence and a power in all of this that is beyond you, and that's what's frightening to people. They think, do I really want to turn myself over to this? What will happen to me? What will happen to my job? What will happen to family? What will happen to my obligations? And will it take me to some place I really want to go to? Perhaps I'll get stuck someplace and I won't be able to get out of it. All of this, these are the doubts that come to the mind, and they, believe me, they are very strong when they come. Because we want to preserve, don't we, this ego self. We want to preserve our control and our will over what we do and what we say. One time when I was down at Mount Washington, I came onto the grounds and it was earlier than the sign said they were open, but the door was cracked open, so I rather boldly went ahead and let myself in. And I came in and I went to the wishing well. As before, it was enclosed in a building as it is today, and so it sat out in the open. And suddenly, as I looked at this wishing well, and I imagined that I gave the wish to Master, his footprints and his handprints along with Sister Gyanamata's are there, and I imagined that I wished for my God realization with all of my heart. But anyway, this power took me over. It felt like a magnetic power that was surrounding this body. And it made me walk around the well 3 times. And then I stopped, and then it did a strange thing. It made me walk backwards around the well 3 times. And not only that, but it continued to make me walk backwards, down a sidewalk, to a street area, across another street, and down and all the way around the tennis courts that were there. All of this was with my eyes mostly closed and walking backwards. Now, how could I do this if this power hadn't taken me over and it wasn't intelligent? It wasn't guiding me step by step. And finally, it took me back up across the street, across the sidewalk, and took me around the wishing well 3 more times. And then it let me go, this power that was controlling and guiding me all the way through. Now, why this experience happened, I don't know. I imagine, one, it was a test for me in a way that, could I surrender myself? What if somebody saw me doing this strange kind of behavior? What would they think of me? You see, so much of what controls and guides the ego is what others will think of us. What will they say? What will they think about us? What will they say to others about us? And we want to be thought well of. We don't want people to think that there's something wrong with us or that we're acting peculiarly or strangely. And at least this was my case. And I was very sensitive to what other people thought. Too much so, in many ways. And so I had to let go of that. I had to transcend and go beyond that. So I had to surrender. And surrender is the most difficult thing to do on our path, because we turn ourselves, our intelligence, our lives, our willpower over to something higher, something greater. But in the beginning, we don't know that it's going to be better. We don't know where it's going to take us to. And gradually, we begin to see ourselves in a new light. By the time that God gave me the injunction to leave my old profession and to do this profession only, and to throw myself at His feet and surrender myself completely there, I was ready and willing to do it. How would I earn a living? How would I be able to survive? I didn't know. But they were not of large concern. I knew that if God were directing me to do this, then He must take care of me. He must take care of me. And indeed He has. Indeed He has. And beautifully so. And when there are times when there is little or no money, then I tell God, You have put me onto this path. You must see to it that this is supported. And if You don't support it, then that means that You didn't really want me to do this. And inevitably, something will come along that will enable us to continue on. And this is the way that it goes. Once Papa was being talked to by several businessmen, and they said, why don't we form a foundation? And with that foundation, we can invest it with money, and that way you always have enough money to keep the operation going here, the ashram. And Papa looked at them and he says, yes, you may do that. Then you may take all of Ram Dass's books, put them into a truck, and dump them in the ocean. Because that's what they'll be worth. Because we don't live that way. We don't live as others live. Now, when you're a householder, there's nothing wrong with having a savings account. It's very prudent to do so. And so you want to keep a savings account, and you want to be able to manage your funds well. Nothing wrong with that. But Papa lived by a different code. And whether you have a bank account or no bank account, it makes no difference, really. You still live by the grace of God. Joel Goldsmith was once talking about this, and he said, now, the millionaire, it may be a rare millionaire, but there may be a millionaire, perhaps he knew of Rajasi, because Rajasi was certainly of this mindset. He is a multimillionaire. But he does not live, and his prosperity does not come from his bank account. He knows, that millionaire does, that his prosperity comes from God. Now just think how tempting it is when you get a little money into the bank, or a lot of money in the bank, or in investments. And to think, all right, I'm okay now because I have these investments, I have this money in the bank. It's so tempting, isn't it? To be able to see your security is coming that way. But what freedom there is when you begin to see that your prosperity really comes from God, even if it comes through the agency of a job that you have, or some savings, or some investments that you have, that's still God. And in your mind, you relate it back that this is God's prosperity coming to you. And when you do so, A great feeling of peace comes over you in a way that does not ever come to those who are completely materially minded. Because no matter how much money you have, no matter how many possessions you have, you know that those things can be taken from you. And if you are living in a very egotistical kind of way, then you're constantly comparing yourself to others. And no matter how wealthy you are, there's somebody up above you. And if they're not above you, then they're competing to get above you. And so it goes on. And never do you rest easy. What is the saying? Something to the effect that uneasy rests the head upon which the crown sits. So even kings were greatly vexed by the things of the world, perhaps even more so. And so there's no guarantees in this world. And the great leveler of all, death, eventually comes calling to one and all. And there is no amount of wealth, there is no amount of security in the worldly sense that helps you then. In fact, in many cases, all of those things that seem to provide security for you in the world now become like dead weights around your ankles. The decisions that you made, the focus of attention that you had, suddenly are no longer helpful to you. In fact, they become detriments. And it's really something to think about. If you really want to live this life well, really live it well. So we go beyond the original, the initial kind of resistance of going into a sattvic consciousness, into a God-tuned life. We fight through those obstacles. We get through those things until it begins to hum inside of us with a spontaneous joy, with a deep peace that is in our hearts, with a wisdom that begins to illumine our thoughts. It is a still, small voice. We put aside all the constant questing of the mind, and we put it on to what is the eternal and absolute truth that is existing inside of me. And that question, the mind cannot answer. It has no faculty for knowing truth. When the worldly leader of the time asked Jesus, "What is truth?" There's no way that Jesus could respond to him in a way that would be satisfactory to a worldly leader. Because for Pontius Pilate, he was somebody who was wedded to this world. And in order to realize the great truth, the absolute truth, he would have to put aside the things of the world and open himself to an interior, deeper truth. He would have to go through the work of tasting the poison of sattvic, so to speak, until it turned into nectar, and to reject the things of the senses and the world and the mind, and realize that those turn to poison with time. Which of us have valued a thing in this world and had that stay with us through our lifetime? Not very many. Most things are disposable, and they've gotten more disposable with time. And so the computer that you buy now in 3 years is obsolete. And on it goes. And so there's nothing secure in this world. There's no real happiness. But how to convince a world that has become so consumed with the idea that the things of the world are going to give me happiness? So many billions of dollars of advertising money is spent every year convincing us that we must continue to buy, we must continue to consume. Now, true enough, we have to buy things in order to survive, and there's nothing wrong with having entertainment or things as long as we can well afford them. But to be constantly addicted to it as if that's the only source of our happiness is a recipe for disaster. Happiness only, in the final account, comes from that deep source within you. And in case you doubt that it really exists in you, I can assure you it does. It does. And the happiness that you can attain from it transcends everything that you have experienced in the world. It grows slowly in the beginning, much too slowly for our liking, especially if we're anxious of it, if we need it, if we're desiring it with everything inside of us, but grow it will. There is a saying that Anande Moyama gave, in which he gave, because somebody is asking, why do we get these hurts along the way? And in one case, a man was asking, I wanted to become a renunciant, but you made me enter into the world and have a family life, and now I have all these problems from it. And she said, exactly right. Because if you had not had these experiences, you would have been thirsting after them in your subconscious mind. These are my words, not exactly hers. And eventually they would have caught up with you. Eventually you would have been wondering what that was like, and it would have tripped you up in your path. But because you've had those experiences in the world, you're satisfied now. You're ready to move on and move forward. And now, you're free to do so. So we live in this world in order to satisfy some of those desire natures that we've had deep in the subconscious mind, but we don't overly cultivate new desires. We work on resolving the ones that we have, and then finally until they settle down, until they come into complete equanimity. And when we have that equanimity of mind, then we find joy springing up within our souls. When established in that joy, we can enjoy the things of this world, but they do not dominate us anymore. They can bring us some pleasure, but they do not. That none of that compares with the bliss of God. And we would never, ever, ever think of trading in the joys of this world for the bliss of God. The bliss of God has now become the dominant theme in our life. So Master continues, the initial state of happiness accompanying sensuality is always followed by unhappiness, owing to the impairment of physical vitality, mental self-control, and spiritual peace. It is the enigma of Maya that the poison of sensual experiences is found to be so pleasant in the beginning. The initially pleasurable taste of the poisonous honey of evil deludes people and so causes them to indulge in harmful experiences. If evil had no charm, nobody would try it. People swallow the bitter pill of evil because it is sugar-coated with immediate pleasure. Worldly people, young and old, are those who overindulge their senses, even after discovering the harmful after-effects. They are still helplessly driven to such excesses by the compelling influences of bad habits. Recipients of rajasic happiness find out too late that undisciplined sensual pleasures turn out to be tormentors, destroying strength, vitality, health, good looks, intelligence, memory, riches, and enthusiasm. Strongly pulled by temptation, worldly rajasic people pursue their materialistic lives without ever knowing the blessedness of spirit hidden within them, in the true peace and joy found in meditation. But toward the end of life, they often feel utterly deceived by the prevaricating senses. Then they find no happiness in anything. Their minds become empty and dark, stalked by goblins of unhappiness. The precept in this stanza is notably relevant to the disillusioning end many youthful, eager materialists encounter. Lured by high hopes of prosperity and physical happiness, they work hard and scheme at the cost of their peace and health, and try vainly to buy more happiness by acquiring more money. As they pass from youth to old age, they suffer a gradual loss of vigor and enthusiasm, and become prey to disease and the fear of approaching death, the great leveler that turns to naught all earthly gains. So let us heed these words well. Let us learn to appreciate, as a connoisseur learns to appreciate perhaps a kind of wine or cheese that is not appealing at first, but gradually gains an allure as they educate the senses about such things. Even though bliss may not come easily, learn to become a connoisseur of the interior joy and bliss that comes with God communion. Love God with all of your heart, all of your strength, all of your mind, with everything that you have. Turn your mind towards that inner divine kingdom. Reach for it until it begins to sing within your soul, and the chorus of that song lifts you into the heavens that are beyond the worldly mind or experience. And it will reveal to you the truths of all time. There are those who sometimes think that going to God must be a dull affair. It would be boring, and who knows what you will become. Just think of this vast universe. Think of all the marvels that we see upon this world that God has wrought. Is that a dull intelligence that has brought all of this forth? Is that an impotent power that has projected itself as this entire creation? It cannot be. And yet this entire universe is but the footstool of the infinite mind, consciousness, and power that we call God. And to really enter into a feeling of communion and oneness with that intelligence and power is beyond everything else that we can experience in this world. So do not delay even a day, even an hour longer, but begin by attuning yourself to that inner vibration, that inner sense. And whenever you think in your mind to turn it toward God, look for that feeling of presence. It may not be there as powerfully as you would like it to be, but I think that you will always be able to find it. There will be some sense of peace. There will be some sense of purity, of light, some feeling for it inside of you when you turn your mind that way. Keep your mind on that feeling, and it will grow. And it will become your friend of friends. It will become your lover, your beloved. It will become your instructor. It will become your all and all, and it will guide you into its own kingdom. A kingdom with many, many rooms, because there are so many experiences to be had within that divine experience. This is the most wonderful, the most powerful, the greatest, the most beautiful thing that you can experience in life. And it is yours but for the asking. Now we have to ask sincerely, strongly, powerfully, without getting distracted, but it is only there for our asking. May you be blessed with that aspiration, that sincere, intense desire for God alone. And let that fill you with the qualities of spirit until you are so full with it, you know that you and that are one, and there is no separation. There is no separation. This is the real key to happiness. Now, if you will pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am he. Pronouns, I bow to the light within you.